As I remember, California State Polytechnic College, San Luis Obispo, presents another in its series of interviews with distinguished retired staff members and associates. This one, George P. Cooper. George, as I recall, you were one of a small group of, well, sort of an advance guard sent down to Cal Poly by Julian A. McPhee in 1931.
Yes, that's right, Cord. Mr. McPhee, who was the State Bureau of Agricultural Education chief, had been interested in Cal Poly as a possible place to coordinate the program of a resident institution here and the program of vocational agriculture in the high schools. The California Polytechnic School in 1931 was in difficulties financially and in its administration, and Mr. McPhee had been quite concerned about it. So he picked a group of four people, each one of whom was given a special function and were hired in the summer of 1931. Now, these included J.I. Thompson, who came here after 10 years on a university program at Davis and as manager of Sterlock Farm. And his job was to be a livestock specialist for the Bureau of Agricultural Education and a livestock advisor for Cal Poly. Sid Sutherland was brought in from Montana, and his job was to be the teacher trainer in California and also to be a farm mechanic specialist. I was brought in to handle public relations, both for California Polytechnic School and for the Future Farmers of America, and George Drum was employed to take over the dairy program here at Cal Poly.
This was followed by additional personnel in 1932?
Yes, that's right. January of 1932, C.O. McCorkle came down here from Red Bluff, and his job was to work as executive secretary of the growing state program of Future Farmers of America and to become chairman of the agricultural division at Cal Poly. Also, in the summer of that year, Vard Shepherd came in as animal husbandry instructor. Harry Parker was hired as beef herdsman and also an agriculture instructor. Alvin Hollenberg came in to teach farm mechanics, and W.B. Ted Howes came in to take over the ornamental horticulture program. Kyle Beck was brought from Colusa High School also in 1932 to organize a Future Farmers of America chapter at Cal Poly and to teach farm skills. Now, Dick Leach and Vernon Meacham were here prior to 1931, and they, together with the 1931 and 1932 editions, plus Jim Merson, who came in 1936, were generally referred to by Mr. McPhee as, quote, the old gang. They formed the nucleus for the later, greatly expanded agriculture faculty.
That was quite a staff at that time, George. Now, when you came here in the fall of 1931, what did you do to carry out the plans of Mr. McPhee?
Well, actually, Card, I only had two instructions pretty much all of the time that I worked here. One was to present to the public a good image of the Future Farmers of America and a good image of Cal Poly. I started out by making contacts with newspaper and agricultural magazine people over the state. And the first year that I was here, I started the publication of the California Future Farmer magazine, which I continued editing until my retirement in 1965. And I also started a radio program and radio contacts with the National Broadcasting Company. And those programs over national, state, and regional networks of NBC continued until 1945. Now, those are the major things that I started out with immediately. Also, as I recall it, in the spring of 1932, somebody put a motion picture camera in my hand and told me, George, you go out and make movies of Future Farmers of America programs in California and Cal Poly. And I'd never seen a movie camera in my life.
You've done real well, though. But then Mr. McPhee came down here from Sacramento and took personal charge in the summer of 1933.
Yes, that's right. As he has said many times, the State Department of Education and the legislature said, well, the only way that we're going to continue Cal Poly is if you go down there and run it. And he did. Many people, though, think that he immediately gave up his work as the chief of the Bureau of Agricultural Education, and that is not true, because he continued his very active program as Bureau Chief, a State Supervisor of Agricultural Education. He just moved his office down here from Sacramento and continued here as the Director of Cal Poly and as Bureau Chief. Of course, at that time, It was necessary because of the small budget, which was $75,000 a year for all expenses at Cal Poly, to let a lot of the previous staff go.
Now, among other things, George, did you teach any classes?
Yes, I did, and that was a traumatic experience, Gib, for not only the students, but for me, because I had been trained as a newspaper man, and I had no experience in teaching. Between 1933 and 1936, I did teach classes at various times in remedial English, in California history, in typing, and a course which I developed myself, which was called farm salesmanship. And I might say that one of my students is now the regional supervisor of agricultural education in the South Coast region here, and that's Emil LaSalle.
Very good. What terminated your teaching responsibilities in 1936?
Well, I've got a lot of kidding about this because I didn't graduate from Oregon State College when I left school in 1925. I got a job in a newspaper, and that's what I went to school for, and I didn't feel any need of getting a degree. But if I was going to continue in an educational program, it was essential that I have at least a Bachelor of Science degree. So I set out by various ways and means to accumulate enough credits to get my degree from Oregon State College, which I did in 1936. And at that time, Mr. McPhee then could put me on the payroll of the Bureau of Agricultural Education as a special supervisor, and that relieved me, and I'm sure the students also.
Sounds interesting. A lot of work, though. I've heard that you served as public relations head for several National Future Farmer conventions. When did this start, and how long did it continue, George?
It started in 1936. The national organization was growing rapidly. They had been bringing out various government publicity men from Washington, D.C. to Kansas City for a period of time, but they did not find this satisfactory. What they were looking for was someone with a considerable newspaper and actual public relations experience and this sort of thing. So I went back each year from 1936 through 1941 for a period of about 2 weeks to handle a national publicity program for the conventions.
Now in the 30s, as you say, the staff was small. Was your work limited to public relations and future farmer statewide activities?
Gib, I can never recall a time when I was active that my work was ever limited to anything. Julian McPhee had an idea that I could do practically anything, which certainly wasn't true, but quite often when he had to go away, he would leave me with some specific responsibilities, almost any kind. I can recall one year that he went up to Yosemite and took his family up there for a vacation, the first vacation he'd had in many years. And at that time, there was a corps of men from the State Division of Architecture that were coming down to investigate the possibility of putting a chemistry lab in what was then called Anderson Hall. It was one of the original buildings. Well, they dug around in there, and they found out that the partitions had been moved from here to there, and the building was absolutely unsafe, and they nailed up the holes again and said there was no possibility of establishing a chem lab there, and as I recall, college was going to start in about 3 weeks. Well, I didn't know what to do. The only thing I could think of was to call the forest ranger up in Yosemite and get a hold of McPhee and tell him to come home. And he hardly got his tent up, and he often tells this, has often told this with quite a little extra flavor on his part, but I'm using this as an example of one of the many odd jobs that I had during that period.
At least they were odd, but also interesting. I know Mr. McPhee worked very closely with the legislature in those early days. Did you have anything to do with this activity?
Yes, in a way, because every legislative period there were various bills that were of interest and concern to Cal Poly. And obviously, Mr. McPhee couldn't remain up there in Sacramento with all the many duties that he had. So there were various times during the legislative sessions when I was assigned to go to Sacramento and sit in the legislative chambers and watch the procedure and progress of various bills. Now, there were some good bills that we wanted passed, and there were some bad bills that we wanted killed. But I had to be very careful and watch the calendar for each succeeding day and see to it what was coming up. During that time, I was given a access card to the state Senate, It was dated ahead for all the remaining days of the legislative session, and it gave me the right to go and sit right down at a desk with any of the senators. This kind of lobbying was properly outlawed after that, but I still have that card which was made out to me, and it's one of the interesting souvenirs that I have.
I seem to recall that 1938 was a highly significant year in Cal Poly history. What were some of the events in that year?
Well, one of them was the acquisition of the Voorhees unit at San Dimas. The Voorhees School had been established 10 years before by C.B. Voorhees and his son Jerry as a private school for boys from broken homes and other boys that needed help. When Jerry Voorhees was elected to Congress, his father found it impossible to carry on the school, and so he was interested in finding some group or agency that would take it over and carry on the type of work that they had started there. And he ultimately got in touch with Mr. McPhee, and to make a long story short, the school was deeded over to Cal Poly. In the same year, Leopold E. Rassi, a raisin grower living near Fresno, a man who had in his lifetime amassed a tremendous amount of money, and yet he had never worked for anything more than day wages as a millwright or with a small income from his grape vineyard. He became interested in the future farmers as a result of being close to the Carruthers chapter over in Fresno County. And through the Carruthers chapter, he found out about the State Future Farmer Program and came over to a convention or two, and ultimately he set up a loan fund of $25,000 at Cal Poly to help needy students here. Third activity that took place that year, Gibb, was the setting up of a degree transfer arrangement with the University of California at Davis. This would permit students at Cal Poly, which by that time had reached a three-year technical college status, to transfer on to the university. However, I might say that this agreement, unfortunately, was not operative because Provost Stanley Freeborn, with whom I had worked on this, found out that he had given Cal Poly transfer students far greater privileges than he would give to students in the University of California, and other people in the university protested about it, so that degree transfer program never developed as we thought it might.
Yes, George, 1938 was a significant year. But wasn't there an interesting public relations angle to the acquisition of the Voorhees unit?
Yes, this goes back to Mr. McPhee's philosophy that Cal Poly was an institution that was set up to serve anyone who could profit by its instruction. As I recall it, there was a citrus grower who lived near the entrance to the Voorhees unit, and who had a son who was a good boy, but he was what you'd call a slow learner. He did come up to Cal Poly and took some of the courses up here, and because of our philosophy here of trying to help any student that came and wanted to learn, he did learn, and he profited by the instruction here. Well, one day, C.B. Voorhees, who was affectionately known as Uncle Charlie, was driving along and stopped to talk to this man, and he said that he was about to turn over the Voorhees unit to the Methodist Church because he felt that that would be a good agency to carry on. This citrus grower said, Mr. Voorhees, before you do that, I suggest that you get a hold of Mr. McPhee at Cal Poly, and because that's just the kind of an institution they have up there, and I think they're the people to carry on down here. Mr. Voorhees, as I recall it, had never heard of Cal Poly and or of Mr. McPhee at that time, but he did get in touch with Mr. McPhee, and because of our good program here and the type of public relations that we had in giving every boy a chance, we did get the Voorhees unit. And I might say that as a result of that step, it was made possible later on to also get the Kellogg Farm.
Very good. And wasn't there another public relations aspect in connection with Mr. Rassi?
Yes, there's good public relations and there's bad public relations, Cord. Mr. Rassi was a very odd individual. He did not present an attractive appearance. He had one kind of a brown suit that looked as if it had been slept in. He was never very cleanly shaved, but he had a heart of gold. And he was also very interested in the 4-H clubs and had made out his will, if I understand the story correctly, to give a very large sum of money to the University of California upon his death for the promotion of 4-H work. Well, at one time when he was at a convention, a 4-H convention at Davis, he was such an unusual-looking spectacle that they seated him on the stage behind a large potted palm plant so that he could not be seen from the audience. Well, Mr. Voorhees might have looked a little bit odd, but he had a keen mind.
You mean Mr. Rassie?
I mean Mr. Rassie. I'm sorry, Gibb. I mean Mr. Rassie. And he realized what was happening to him, and so he came home, and if the story that I've heard is correct, he changed his will and ultimately gave virtually all of his money to California State Polytechnic College.
That's an interesting story, George. I know President McPhee was extremely busy and worked very hard. Were you able to keep up with the terrific pace set by him?
Well, in 1938 and 39, things were beginning to build up. I was carrying on 4 radio programs, doing all the public relations work for Cal Poly and the Future Farmers, and developing 2 full-length sound movies for the Treasure Island show that was coming up, and I just felt that I couldn't keep up the program any longer. So I asked Mr. McPhee if it wouldn't be possible to employ somebody to come in and take over part of my work. And at that time, we did employ Ernie Foster for a year.
Was it about that time that you had an unusual experience with a train?
Yes, it was, Cord. I'd been going down to Hollywood on weekends to see if we couldn't get a better system of putting the sound on the soundtrack for our films. And one time I was supposed to go to San Francisco, but I had a taxi ordered for the wrong train. And all of a sudden I woke up to the fact that that train that I wanted to take to San Francisco was about to leave the station. I called the taxi driver, who was affectionately known here as Whistle McInerney, and asked what I could do. He said, George, he said, you go right out in front of your house. I lived on California Boulevard at that time, and stop there, wait out there, and I'll call the station. So in a few minutes, he called me back again, and he said, you get your suitcase and get out on the track. He said, the train is just leaving. This was a Sunset Limited with 2 engines on, and get out there, and they'll pick you up. So I walked across the road from my house and got out on the track, and when the locomotives came along, I got out in the glare of the headlight and thumbing my way just like the kids do on the highway. The train stopped with the Pullman right straight in front of me. I got on, and the conductor said, Mr. Cooper, your berth is ready, and I have your tickets. I don't claim anything at all except that that's exactly what happened.
It's a true story, is it, George?
It's a true story.
It was an unusual experience. Probably never will happen again. Now, in 1940, the State Board of Education took a significant step relative to Cal Poly. Were you present at this historic event?
Yes, I was, Cord. This was the action on the part of the State Board of Education to give Cal Poly the right to grant a Bachelor of Science degree. Now, I might say that over the years, the University of California did not want Cal Poly to assume full college status. The land-grant colleges had been given the privilege over many years in most states to be the only institution to grant degrees in agriculture, and the university did not want to give up that privilege. So they had stalled off by means of persuasion and asking for committees and investigations and so on. The repeated suggestion on the part of Mr. McPhee that Cal Poly be entitled to grant the Bachelor of Science degree. At this meeting in 1940, it was recognized that there were 4 of the board members that were for Cal Poly, there were 4 that were opposed to Cal Poly getting the degree, and there were 2 that were uncommitted. It was difficult for Mr. McPhee to talk to members of the board because he was so well known to all of them that for him to do so would they'd make some of them suspicious, but they didn't know me at all. So on the evening before this great event took place, I wandered over to the Senator Hotel, and the members of the board were there in the lobby talking, and I overheard one of them say, well, That Cal Poly matter won't come up tomorrow because Dr. Dexter, the state superintendent, says he isn't going to bring it up. So I went back and reported this to Mr. McPhee, but he agreed, and some of the board members agreed, that they could bring up anything they wanted to. They were appointed by the governor, and they were not limited to matters that were brought up by Dr. Dexter. So the next morning, I had breakfast with two of our very good friends on the State Board of Education, Ford Chatters and Armistead Carter. And it was agreed that one or the other, would bring up the matter and move that the State Board grant Cal Poly the permission to give the Bachelor of Science degree. This was brought up, and the silence was one of those things you could cut with a knife, because most of the State Board were not aware this was going to happen. In fact, Dr. Crutcher, the president of the board, was so shook about it, but he was also so sure it wouldn't pass, that he actually called for an immediate vote on it. The vote was taken, and perhaps much to everybody's surprise, there were 6 board members voted for it, and 4 voted against it, and Dr. Crutcher banged down the gavel and said, so ordered. And that, accord, is the way Cal Poly got its Bachelor of Science degree. Mr. and Mrs. McPhee were there, and we went home with considerable jubilation.
He had reason to celebrate. And in 1940, the man who is now Cal Poly's president, Robert E. Kennedy, came here to assume part of your previous responsibilities.
Yes, that's right. I had interviewed Bob and other people at Mr. McPhee's request and had recommended to Mr. McPhee that Bob Kennedy be hired. He had the capability and the ability and the desire to take over the Cal Poly part of my responsibilities, but unfortunately, Mr. McPhee had become so accustomed to just picking up the phone or coming around and looking in my door and say, George, I want you to do something. It was very difficult for him to turn immediately to Bob Kennedy. So while I would like to say that it relieved me of a lot of work, it didn't exactly at that time. And then very shortly after that, the World War came along and Bob was given other responsibilities. So my services did go on for some little time after that.
What was your professional reaction when World War II broke out?
Well, Gib, I wanted to get in and do something of value and consequence in the war program and the war effort. I knew that with only sight in one eye that I wasn't going to be get in the trenches, but I really wanted to do something productive. Mr. McPhee convinced me that food and agriculture were just as important as guns and fighting, and that there were many things that I could do to aid in the war effort without joining the Army or going to work in a war plant.
But you did find much to do in aiding the war effort.
Yes. The Bureau of Agricultural Education very shortly became embroiled in the matter of training students for harvest work during the summertime, training prisoners of war, training Mexican nationals, and so on. I wrote a booklet which was called Farm Victory Service, which was quite widely illustrated and went into considerable detail. And this was to be given to particularly urban high schools to help them orient the students properly and give them a little background in farm harvest work. Another job that I set out to do was to make 22 film strips of harvesting various California crops. I took hundreds of pictures in both black and white and in color and developed film strips and slide series to help train people in crop harvesting. By way of a little sidelight, just about the time that those were all completed and in production and were actually being used in a few places, the Agricultural Extension Service was given the total program or farm labor as a wartime responsibility, and I can't say that my film strips and film slide series were given a tremendous amount of use beyond that point.
In 1944, Mr. McPhee gave up his position as chief of the State Bureau of Agricultural Education and appointed Byron McMahon as bureau chief. Did this change the emphasis of your work?
Yes, it did, Card. Mr. McMahon had many varied responsibilities, including various wartime programs of school community canneries and job instruction program, a growing young farmer program, and so on. And he was very happy for me to pretty much take over the operational and state activity phase of the Future Farmers of America. And I began to work more particularly in that area, and that continued pretty much up till the time that I retired in 1965.
Now, Mr. McPhee became State Director of Vocational Education. Did you work with him in this responsibility, too?
Yes, in a limited way. I recall that I edited a publication called the Golden State Vocational Observer, which came out several times a year, and also I accompanied him to various meetings and helped prepare various material that he wanted, yes.
Were you called upon after these years to perform any services in connection with Cal Poly?
Well, Card, I really can never remember a time right up to the present time when I wasn't called on from time to time to do something for Cal Poly based on some earlier experience or some supposed capability that I had. So I can't ever point to the time when my services were no longer in demand.
You've always done a good job, George, in anything. What was the first year you took a large group of California Future Farmers to the National Convention?
Well, that was in 1946, and that was called the Victory Convention because the war was over, and I was a little over-enthusiastic and recruited about 125 boys. There were some problems that developed that year, and we discovered that it was necessary to carefully screen the boys and to take only those that were highly recommended and that had achieved some kind of an award. And in all the years after that, there was nothing but the finest of relationships, but that was quite a year.
Sounds like it. This, too, was about the time that acquisition of the Kellogg property became a moot topic. Were you involved in that in any way?
Well, in a very small way. I recall going down there several times and visiting the property and working with Mr. McPhee and drawing up some rough drafts of a tentative agreement with the Kellogg Foundation and so on. I also remember writing a letter from Mr. McPhee to Clinton Anderson, who was then the Secretary of Agriculture, urging that the property ultimately be given to Cal Poly.
Wasn't there also a significant public relations circumstance here?
Well, yes, this is another one of those stories. But it is said that Claude B. Hutchinson, who was the Dean of Agriculture at the University of California, made a speech in Pomona in which he said that if the Kellogg unit, which had been operated by the university for quite a number of years prior to the war, were returned to the university, that they would subdivide it and sell the property and put the money in the university treasury. Well, this Kellogg horse unit at this Kellogg farm was a very important and sacred thing to the Kellogg people. And when they heard that the university would sell the property if they got it back again, I know the Kellogg Foundation vowed that they would make use every means at their command to see to it that the property never went back to the University of California. And this was a significant factor in Cal Poly ultimately getting the unit.
Very good. Now, George, in 1953, the Bureau of Agricultural Education headquarters was moved back to Sacramento for the first time in 20 years. Did this make a major change in your responsibilities?
No, not particularly. At that time, my relationship with Mr. McMahon was one in which I understood that he was the state advisor and was in charge of the policies of the FFA, and that I was to carry on with the activities and the operational part of the program. And we kept each other advised by mail and telephone. And it actually did not make any particular difference, no.
Your final year in 1964-65, George, this was one of many memories, I'm sure.
Yes, that's right, Gibb. At that time, vocational education was undergoing a procedure in which there were plans afoot to change a number of the things that I thought were vital to the morale and to the conduct of a successful vocational agriculture program, and I opposed these very bitterly. And that perhaps was an unfortunate part of my final year, but I couldn't do otherwise. I felt very deeply about it. On the other hand, during that year, I had so many wonderful things happen to me in the way of recognition by various agencies that It was just unbelievable. So it was a very significant year, and in general, a tremendously happy and rewarding one.
You deserve every bit that you receive, George. And I know you have been busily occupied in your retirement.
Yes, that's right, Cord. We had planned for some time that as soon as possible after I retired that we would leave and go to Europe. We had seen people who had retired and stayed right in the same area where they could go out to the office frequently and worry about their successor and how things were all probably going to pot. And it was our desire to just simply get out of the country where there was no way for me to worry about anything and no way for my successor to get a hold of me. So we did take off, and we spent 10 wonderful months in Europe and made a clean break, and I think that was a very wonderful thing. And then after a period at home, the Becks and the Coopers took off this last summer and drove to Fairbanks, Alaska, and as many people have heard, we did get involved in the Fairbanks flood, but all in all, it was also a very interesting and very rewarding experience, and we're very happy we took it.
Thank you, George, for participating in this program. This interview in the series, As I Remember, has been conducted by J. Cordner Gibson.